House Committee on Revenue will come to order for February 25th, 2016. Merry Christmas. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1506. Kyle, do you want to give us a quick explanation of this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1506, the committee member heard this back on the 12th. And it's making a modification, what you could probably say is a technical change, to an existing property tax exemption, the food processing exemption, that was expanded during the 2015 legislative session. And as part of that, included in the governor's signing statement, was one thing picked up as a technical fix of making the change related to the minimum real market value. Rather than using real market value to qualify, you'd use cost of initial investment of $100,000. So it's still $100,000. But instead of using a qualification of real market value, you do cost of initial investment. And the idea there being, of course, is cost of initial investment is more of an accounting figure where real market value is still a value. So there is an estimate involved in placing that value.
You can send an invoice, copy of an invoice to the assessor, and you're done.
Exactly. That's the idea, Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Any discussion? Representative Benz?
Chair, move Senate Bill 1506 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 1506 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Representative Hoyle will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill, or Senate Bill 1506, and open a work session on Senate Bill, a public hearing on Senate Bill 1513. Is that yours, too?
Yeah.
Would, give us the explanation. Let's see who's here. Oh, Senator Girard is here. Anyone else? Any other member here to speak? Let's have the members up first.
Representative Boone is here.
Yes, and I see her.
Sure.
Go ahead. Give us the explanation, and then we'll hear from the members.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart.
Just a moment. We'll hear the explanation, and then we'll hear from the members.
Please. Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll try to be brief. So SB 1513, it's a permissive property tax exemption. It allows the county by an ordinance or resolution to exempt up to $250,000 of assessed value of homesteads of surviving spouses of a fire service professional, police officer, or a reserve officer that's killed in the line of duty. It does require the surviving spouse to remain unmarried in order to qualify for the exemption.
Great. Thank you.
The language in there does specify that the exemption applies to all ad valorem property taxes for all taxing districts, so it's not just the county taxing districts, but all the taxing districts that impose tax. And there is a definitional information there on what defines a homestead, so it is owner-occupied primary residence is the requirement. And then there are requirements for the surviving spouse to file applications and provide proof of killed in the line of duty and so forth when they're applying for the exemption. And would take effect the 91st day, sunny day.
Thank you. General, I know that you're in the panel, so why don't you come up too, and then we'll hear from the good senator. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. For the record, I am Senator Fred Girard, and I'm off the floor. We're still actually on the floor debating bills today for some strange reason, and I represent Senate District 9. I'm here today to introduce Senate Bill 1513A to the committee. This bill, I believe, passed unanimously out of the Senate. It's very simple by design. It allows counties to offer property tax relief to the surviving spouse of the first responder, defined as police officer, reserve officer, and fire service professionals who die in the line of duty. It imposes a ceiling of $250,000 of the assessed value for the homestead. The exemption can include all taxes, fees, charges, assessments imposed for the property. It is important to point out that the bill is permissive. It is a may, not a shall. The sideboards can be put on the county. Basically, the county is the gatekeeper in this bill. It has 12 public safety organizations that support the bill. Briefly, I'll just read them real quickly. The State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, the Oregon Peace Officers Association, the AFL-CIO, the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Oregon Fraternal Order of Police, the Oregon Volunteer Fighters Association, and the Oregon Association of Reserve Peace Officers. To make a long story short, these people put their lives on the line every time they go out. It can be a simple traffic stop that can end their life. It can be serving a warrant that can end their life. This just allows the state to say, you know, thank you for their service, and we got your back. And that's basically what the bill did. I'm going to let the good representative here talk about the incident that happened in Seaside. Senator Johnson, I know, wanted to be here to testify and support as well. We just really need to do something. This doesn't amount to very much money. And it is, again, it's permissive and allows the county to put the sideboards on that they want and allows the county to decide if they even have the money to do it. But I think it's a very good bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you need to hustle back to the floor, you certainly may do that. Or you can stick around for questions.
I'll stick around for questions.
Thank you. Representative.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, including Seaside, where Jason Gooding, a sergeant police in Seaside, was killed in action on February 5th, serving a warrant. And the person who killed him had a long record of offenses, and especially offenses of assaulting officers. And Sergeant Gooding was one of the most beloved people in our community. His colleagues, his friends, his family, everybody. He was the coach at the schools for many, many different teams. He's just an all-around good guy, always taking part in everything there is in community. And just, you know, drew the short straw on this one. This was a terrible mistake and, terrible tragedy. It wasn't a mistake. It was a confrontation by this person who should not have been out of jail or prison. He should have been there, and who had in his possession, as a felon, multiple felon, he had a weapon in his possession, and that's what he used to kill the officer. When the officer tried to take him down, he'd been tased, and it barely did anything to him. He was on meth and heroin and alcohol at the time. And he kept saying to the police, you know, you're not going to like this, you're not going to like this. And all they did was tase him. Sergeant Gooding went down and tried to cuff him, and the guy stuck his gun up under the vest and killed him. And he was shot by the partner three times and died on the way to the hospital. And in all this going on, the fire department in Seaside was the response. Those people know each other. They all know each other. One of his best friends had to do CPR on the perp, and that was very tough for him. So a few days later, they had a big processional and funeral in memorial in the town, and there were over 2,500 vehicles. It was 12 miles long, and by the time the last ones left the start point, these guys were getting to from Camp Rylea. They were there, but they stretched all along the Highway 101, and with no police traffic or anything, cars just pulled over, stopped, people got out, saluted, put their hand, I mean, I'm going to cry, I just know it, but it was amazing. The funeral itself was 3 hours long to get through it, and many, many tributes to him. And you just could not believe how many people from New York City to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police showed up. So many people from all, probably I could confidently say somebody from each of your districts was there, from police, fire, you name it. And it, at the end of that day, at 6 o'clock, they started doing the counseling to people. Fire department, police department was just in chaos, just a mess. People were just so upset. And everybody, to a person, and this is my point, what can we do? What can we do? We want to do something. You bring food, you know, the group that coordinates all the activity, bringing food and comfort to the families. And the first responders, they did a beautiful job of that. But you still are left with, what can I do? We can send money to the fund that's helping them, which they really needed. But this, when Senator Gerard came to me with this bill, 1531 or 1513, I thought, this is wonderful, and this is the perfect thing to do. This this widow can really use this, and this will really help the family. And in my case, I know there are others, and as he said, there aren't a lot, but when this happens, it's devastating to a community, and I am so proud to support this, and I hope that you will be too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Genoa Ingram, I won't repeat what's been said already. Just I represent the Oregon Fire District Directors Association and the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. Both organizations support the bill. When this came up the first time, if memory serves, the discussion at that time centered around Officer Lipke, who was a reserve officer who was killed in Clackamas County. And while many people were supportive of the bill, there were some issues that caused some people, gave them pause, such as, is this the principal residence? What if they own multiple residents? What if there's a remarriage? What if they own a, you know, $3 million home or something of that nature? This bill does address those obstacles that were previously brought up, and I just urge your support, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Senator Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief. I would like to be Senator Betsy Johnson, District 16. I had the privilege of speaking at Sergeant Gooding's memorial, and I would like to be associated with the supporters of this bill. This is tangible testimony to the ultimate sacrifice and the least we can do for a young widow and two grieving children. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. John Bishop, Michael Salvaggio, please. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, representatives of the House Revenue Committee. My name is John Bishop. I'm a retired sheriff and currently am the executive director for the Oregon State Sheriffs Association. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Chiefs of Police and the Oregon Sheriffs Association in strong support of Senate Bill 1513A. I'm not going to read everything that I was going to. It's posted because it would just redo everything that you've already heard. So I'm also on the Governor's Task Force for the Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice. Unfortunately, we have met way too many times over the last several years. The families of our first responders live with the constant reality that their loved ones may not return home safe from their heroic workday. In today's society, the work of our police officers is increasingly complex, and it is dangerous, as in the three deputies that found out yesterday just doing a civil eviction in Colorado. The loss of an officer like Seaside Police Department Sergeant Gooding, who was a friend of all of us, who lost his life while serving a felony warrant, illustrates the devastating impact that it has on the officer, the police department, his family, and the community. As a law enforcement leader who tries to do everything to make sure that we ensure that our officers and our deputies come home, we support every effort by you to help the families of the police officers who make a greater sacrifice while serving our communities. We all urge the committee to pass Senate Bill 1513 and appreciate your consideration of this important benefit for the families. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Salvaggio.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio. I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, which represents line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. I want to offer our words of support on Senate Bill 1513. I'm not going to read the testimony that we've already provided, nor am I going to try to outword some of the previous testimony. But just from a line officer perspective, we recognize that every single day our members are putting their lives on the line, potentially. And although we have procedures in place, we can never be fully prepared for the loss of one of our own. And as much as we offer counseling and have community support and provide an honorable end of watch, I don't want the committee to underestimate the very real comfort that this kind of alleviation of a financial burden could bring to the families. So I appreciate the committee's consideration and hope that you pass the bill out.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. Jody Weiser, please. And is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill today? I expect we're going to work it today, so this may be your only opportunity.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. Rep. Barnhart and the rest of the committee. This is probably one of the hardest pieces of testimony of the session, but there are, these people are paid because of the risk they have. They have insurance because of the risk they have. And this benefit is 10 times the benefit that we offer to vets families who are lost in the line of duty or are damaged at 40% level. And it's hard to understand the how we would make the choice to have that much difference in the subsidy we're giving in property taxes for two groups of people. We also don't have anything for the families of the people who aren't saved in fires or are killed by mistake by officers. And that would be another group that we could pay attention to. The problem is that the more times we look for ways to help specific individuals, the less funds we have available for our basic responsibilities. And so we're really choosing something that feels good now and will kind of disappear into the tax code forever, but will mean more days of school that are lost for funding as time progresses. And that's the kind of choice you have to make. Because, you know, do you do the specific thing that's really, really hard to vote against because it's so compelling and stay true to the basic responsibilities, or do you, how do you vote? It's tough. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you, Jody. We appreciate your testimony. I'm sorry. Yes, please.
I just want to say thank you for making the point. What crossed my mind was, what about the teachers and professors and instructors who died in the course of these shootings around the state, the guards who die in the line of duty at the prisons? And I appreciate your testimony because there are other people also who are dying in the line of duty for their state because
right.
of their jobs.
And these people actually recognize the risk and are compensated for the risk. And, you know, I mean, it's a great gesture, but and it's wonderful to do gestures, but that's what those funds at the banks are for, I think. Thank you.
Representative Helen?
Oh, no.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 1513 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1513. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1513 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benson moves Senate Bill 1513 to the floor, 1513A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Yes, Representative Benson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I want to comment on something I've noticed in the 9 years I've been here, and that is that we tend to respond as we're doing in this bill, and of course I'll be supporting it, but it might be worthwhile for us to look at the cumulative benefits that we have been generating over these years, and at some point check to see just what all we've done, and then take a look at these things and say, all right, is this the best way we could be responding to this need? Because of course all of us are going to vote for this. There's so many good reasons to do so, but on the other hand, just as Jody pointed out, we need to perhaps look at the bigger picture, and I would hope sometime between now and next session, perhaps I'll get time to do that. Perhaps I won't, but it's something we should be thinking about.
And perhaps the property exemption work group will have a chance to look at that.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Other discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the bill goes to the floor. Representative Barker has agreed to carry the bill, and he will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1513. Colleagues, I wanted to note that we posted the working amendment, the Dash 14 amendment on Senate Bill 1565 just a few minutes ago. Because of our rule, it can't be adopted until a few minutes, less than an hour from now. And we also don't have the paperwork yet done on that bill. What I'm going to do at this moment is recess until 2:15. Keep your eyes open. It may be that we still don't have the paperwork at 2:15, in which case we may recess to a later time. But there's no reason to stay in the committee room. You have other things you can do with the next 45 minutes. And so We'll recess until 2:15, and then I expect to do the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1565. That's the plan at this moment. With that, committee's in recess. It came. We have it all now. House Committee on Revenue will come back to order. Thank you, colleagues. It is now 2:15, as the clock shows. Actually, it's quite a bit later than that. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1565. We're going to, the intention of the chair is to work the Dash 14 amendments today. And so I think Kyle's comments are going to be focused on that, and it is posted. And we'd like testimony, since you're all here, to be focused using that as the basis for the conversation today.
Okay. Once again, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1565, we do have, yes, the Dash 14 amendment, and then there's also in OLIS you'll find an overview of what's in the Dash 14 amendment and how that differs from the underlying bill, the 1565A. So I'll start with try to give an overview of the 1565A as the parts that are remaining and unchanged, and then I'll go in and spend most of the time on the Dash 14 changes and explaining those. But so the underlying measures, 1565, it's a permissive property tax exemption. So it's allowing a city or a county by an ordinance or resolution to provide a property tax exemption or a deferral for newly constructed or installed industrial improvements with the requirement the cost of initial investment is at least $2 million. That's a change. I'll get to that in just a second. The underlying bill was $1 million. And it provides an exemption only to the property with cost of initial investment between that $2 million and $25 million. So property that, say, has a cost of initial investment of $30 million could still qualify, but it would be maxed out at that $25 million. So the other $5 million would be taxable as normal. The exemption, the way the bill's set up, there's what you can think of as almost a standard exemption or possibly deferral language, but the standard exemption would be for any three of 5 years. So it could be an exemption for years 1, 2, 3 or years 1, 3, 5, but it would be three of those years. There is, as it is permissive, it does allow flexibility for the county or the city to deviate from that 3 years and possibly provide an exemption based upon a percentage schedule. So you could do 100% in year one, 50% in year two, something to that effect, or even at the max, you could provide a full 5 year full exemption. So those are still within the bill. It does require governing bodies representing 75% or more of the total combined rate of taxation on qualified property to agree to the ordinance or resolution that's adopted or put out there by the city or the county. So the city or the county would put together an ordinance or resolution, they'd release it, and then you'd have to get 75% of the combined tax rate of taxation of the districts to agree to that. Otherwise, the ordinance resolution does not take effect. So that's an important component there. Also, to deviate from the standard model of the 100% exemption for 3 years, the city or the county has to adopt an ordinance or resolution and receive public testimony from the county assessor regarding the cost and administrability of the proposed terms of the exemption. There are provisions in the bill that do not allow the property to receive other exemptions. So if you're going to receive the exemption here in 1565, then you can't also receive another property tax exemption either going forward after this exemption has ceased or prior to it on that property, with the one exception being the facilities under construction exemption, which is a two-year exemption while you're building the property. I think that probably hits on the high points, the general high points, at least for the underlying bill. So I'll go ahead and shift gears then to what's in the A14 amendment. And this is where I'll be referring to the overview that's in OLIS. We'll try to get that. We can put that up on the screen as well. So with the A14 changes, the first one I have, I guess, labeled as number one there, that has a number of provisions, was an attempt to line and up some of the economic development provisions in the measure, which right now are so the county or city may adopt different economic incentives as requirements. In this case, these would become a shall. So there would be shall requirements, and they're formulated in some sense, on the requirements that are out there in the enterprise zone statutes. They had to be tweaked, of course, to fit within the 15-16-5 exemption or deferral, but that's the basis for them. The first would be requiring the applicant, and I should actually take a step back. There's almost two steps you can think of this, really. You have the initial ordinance or resolution that comes out from the city or the county. That's what the taxing districts have to agree to. And then the secondary, there's almost a secondary application process with the city or the county, and that's where they can start to discuss some of the flexibility that they have in some of the economic incentives. And I'll get to that a little bit more in a second. But so the required incentives, or the required employment requirements, are that you'd have an increase in employment by a greater of 110% of the annual average employment, or annual average employment plus one employee. So it's the greater of those two, and that would be at the location that's receiving, that would receive this exemption. There are provisions in there where it prohibit the applicant from closing or permanently curtailing operations at other locations located 30 plus miles from the location of the site applying for the exemption. So, and I'll go to the second bullet point and then circle back. But for locations,
excuse me, just a moment. Yep. Representative Bass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us an example, some numbers on sub A? 110% of. Can you take us through give us a hypothetical, please?
Yes, Representative Bass. So, if it's contemplating so an expansion of an existing industrial property. So if you're expanding out, you're adding machinery and equipment, or you're building out or something to that effect, it based upon your employment that you have right now. So it's saying the greater of 110% or one. So if you have 10 employees now, you would add one. If you have 100 employees, you'd go to the 110% at that point.
No.
And those are, that's taken pretty close to word for word from the enterprise zone. So the way it's described in the Business Oregon's website is, at minimum, you're talking one employee.
Go ahead. Oh, did you have something? No, go ahead.
So the sub B and C, the first I spoke about was about 30 miles more. Really, the idea here is to make sure if you're raising employment at the location once you're receiving the exemption, you're not also then cutting it somewhere else. So the first is about 30 miles or more from the site. For locations within 30 miles of the site that's applying for the exemption, it would prohibit the application from closing or permanently curtailing operations at other locations within that 30 miles, unless the employment at the location that would receive this exemption is increasing more or less proportionally to the losses. So you'd still have to have that one employee or 110% overall. But the example here would be if you have, let's say you're expanding operations and it's not necessarily at the same site, it's at a different site, but they're within 30 miles. If you're bringing over some of those employees from an existing plant to your new plant, which you've built out, that would be okay so long as you're raising the overall level of employment. But that's, of course, within the 30 miles. Let's see, going on to sub D, it does require the applicant for exemption to enter in a first source hiring agreement. That's defined in the enterprise zone statutes, and then there's also some rules out there, business development, I believe, that go into greater detail.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, yes, Representative, what's it?
So page 10, Section 5, sub C, first source hiring agreement means an agreement between an applicant and a publicly funded job training provider, whereby the provider refers qualified candidates to the firm for new jobs and job openings in the firm. So that's, could we have a definition of a publicly funded job training provider? What would be inclusive in that?
Representative Woods, I don't have that at this time. I had just only I know there is some rules out there on the Business Oregon that may contain that, but I haven't had a chance to go through it completely right now.
Is anyone here?
Well, among them are the things that are funded through the Employment Department. I'm thinking about also veterans employment, that kind of thing. Publicly funded, of course, would include the federal government's actions in areas like that, where we're trying to get workers who are displaced into new employment. And if I understand this requirement correctly, and please correct me if I've misunderstood it, it simply requires them to consider these systems. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There's a process to go through, but certainly there's not direct requirement of having to hire a certain person or anything to that effect. And then going on to E there in the last portion, and this is where it's really a different between the ordinance and resolution that is agreed to by the local taxing districts. Sub E allows a county or a city at the time of the application to establish other reasonable conditions related to economic development at the time of the application. So you have the minimum requirements of the one job or the 110% and also not reducing employment out at other locations. But this would also allow the county or the city to go above and beyond those with reasonable conditions that they would like to see. But that's at the time of the application to the county or the city. Okay. Number two, it's just the moving of the sunset from right now under 1545, the sunset's in 2027. That would move that earlier to 2024. The initial cost of investment is being increased from $1 million to $2 million. So to qualify, you'd have to have initial cost of investment of $2 million. Number four is a requirement about, in the bill, there's now a definition for eligible location. So to qualify for the exemption, the property has to be located at what's termed an eligible location, which is defined as land and improvements that are classified under the property tax classing, which could be different than some of the zoning, but it's under the property tax classing as industrial property with a real market value of at least $1 million for the previous property tax year. So the idea here is for the qualifying property, that's $2 million or more of cost of initial investment, but it has to be placed at a location that prior to the application being submitted, so the year before, has a value, a real market value for the industrial property, both either the land or the improvements, of $1 million. So it really makes it more fall in line with an expansion of a current industrial property or facility that's out there. Number five is including reporting requirements to go up on the Oregon Transparency website. So there's a listing there of the type of information that will be submitted by the city or the county. It's their responsibility to submit it to Department of Revenue, who will then put it in a format they can then forward on to the Oregon, to DAS, to post on the Transparency website. And that'll be in the year following when they get the exemption. So that information will become available. And then the number six is, this goes in line with the eligible location definition, but it requires the eligible property to be located in a rural area, which is defined as an area located entirely outside of the urban growth boundary of a city with a population of 40,000 or more. And this lines up with the rural SIP language that we have in statute currently. So you'd have to be located outside of that city with a population of 40,000 or more to be in a rural area.
Okay. Let's hear from some witnesses. Bill Cross, Doug Schmidt. Tommy, is it Tommy? Tammy? Little? Maybe we'll get to Bill in a few minutes.
Is he upset about something?
I'm really just asking questions about the amendment.
Oh.
Okay, so we're going to hear from the technical people first. Please.
I guess. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor. And
Bill? Bill, you're up.
Do you want to let him go first?
Whatever you want, like, is fine.
I think that'd be good, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. In fairness to the witnesses, they've only seen this amendment for about an hour and a half.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Willamette Valley Vineyards, and we appreciate all the work of the Senate, and particularly Senator Boquist, the assistance from the cities and the counties, special districts, assessors, Department of Revenue, who have all provided, I think, some very good recommendations on the base, on the concept of trying to provide an incentive for maybe smaller to mid-sized employers, industrial land owners who would be doing capital improvements, new construction, and this might be a means, an alternative, and not like your strategic investment programs for the large businesses, and a little different from the enterprise zone in that they might not be in the urban areas. They may be isolated properties. They may have they're investing in structures that may not have a quick return. And so, for example, Willamette Valley Vineyards, when they expanded their project, they built a barrel room that's not going to sell any wine for 3 to 5 years, and it might have been nice to have helped feather in sort of the property tax. And that was the concept. So we're very interested in seeing the bill improved. We are reviewing the Dash 14 amendments and do have concerns on several of them. And at this time, I think we'd find it hard to support the Dash 14s in their entirety. We are fine with the trying to interject the or use similar criteria as you would for enterprise zones in terms of economic development requirements, first source, employment improvements, and modifying the sunset date is fine. I think we're concerned about the definition of qualifying properties. That would eliminate, I think, a lot of opportunities out there in more rural areas. And I think we're also concerned about increasing the amount of the threshold for improvements to qualify from the $1 million to $2 million. The original bill allows a city or county the flexibility of adopting a program, and it could be from anywhere from $1 million up to $25 million, or anything in between. And that seemed to provide the kind of flexibility that maybe various counties might want to look at or cities might want to look at for certain kinds of needs or economic development opportunities that they see in their communities. Can I answer any questions?
Well, why don't we start with that, because I think you're going to be talking about the technical issues,
yes,
aren't you? I appreciate it. Are there questions for him? Because I have some. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, thanks for your testimony and so forth. I guess I want to go back to perhaps what the nexus of the original legislation was, which I think could have been a tool for expansion or creation of, well, let's just say wineries or winery facilities on ag land and so forth. Do you feel, is it your, you've had an hour and a half to look at the Dash 14s, do you think that the land definition as it, you find it in the 14s is going to make that problematic, or is it still at the same level that was in the base bill?
I think it will make it problematic.
Okay.
I mean, I think it will adversely, significantly impact eligible properties.
Could you tell us exactly which component it is you're referring to, so that I make sure, so I can understand what we're talking about? Is it the, and I'm, I don't have it in front of me. Is it the piece that has to do with the value of the initial land? Is it,
yes,
the piece that,
yes,
has to do with the amount of the investment that has to be made, or is it both?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's section. It's on page 1, section 1, sub 1B, where it talks about have real market value of at least,
okay,
$1 million. That's a significant change from the original.
I agree. It is a significant change.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Davis.
I think in that same vein, I would also offer up that the definition on the summary under point 6, mm-hmm, which does dovetail the rural SIP definition, which is sort of a brain bender. You have to think about what it applies to. So if you can scroll down to bullet 6 on the screen, which is the requirement that the eligible property be located in an area defined entirely outside of an urban growth boundary of a city with a population of 40,000 or more. We've dealt with that definition in a brain-bending way multiple times in this committee. I think that also really needs work, and those of us who've touched on the SIP program have all agreed it needs work, and I think that that will exclude a fair number of properties.
Yeah. Was that one was not one that you were listing?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I was trying to research that one. I just haven't had sufficient time to figure out what that meant.
Okay.
I was welcoming this hearing so I could get a chance to better understand it. But that would be a concern if it's interpreted that way.
Other questions for Bill? Thank you. Let's go on to talk about the technicals.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm also testifying on behalf of the Assessors Association. I, too, want to thank Senator Boquist on the Senate side for the work that he did on this to help us be able to administer this bill. We still have a few concerns. One of them is that there is a lot of flexibility in the bill, even though we are allowed to testify at a city before city council if they change and use some of that flexibility. That is still a concern. Because it just adds more complexity to the administration. And the fact that there's a deferral option, there are some deferral programs. The deferral program that we use for, say, like the large utilities, Comcast, when they're under appeal, there is a property tax deferral on that. But that, at this point, that may or may not even be a liability. Because if, depending on how the courts rule, the senior deferral program is different. Even though it's a deferral program, the taxes are still paid. This would, and Tammy can talk to this. She's the president of the Tax Collectors Association. But it does create a lien on the property that would have to be resolved. We would ask a couple things for consideration. Is that the flexibility that to allow varying degrees of exemption, different time periods, things like that, that are in section 4B. I'm not sure on the new amendment. That is on page 2, line 29. That allows a city or county to do a lot of variations. We would ask that be removed. We also ask that you consider removing the whole deferral section and just make it a straight exemption, because we're just questioning how many businesses would actually use that, where they end up having to pay the tax on assets that may be depreciated out in 5 years. And then one thing that I apologize for, I did not testify in the Senate, was there is no date on when the application and information has to be to the assessor. There is a date on when it has to be submitted to the city or county, but there is no date when they have to submit it to us. And we would just ask that a date of April 1st or April 15th, which is typical for exemption applications, that the city has to get that information to us by a date. On a little bit different note, but tying in with the flexibility and the local control, we've noticed from an assessor's association there's been a lot of permissive bills in the last few sessions with local control, and some of those cause us difficulty in efficiently administering the bills. And I would just like to throw out as an option that in the future, when bills come forward that have a lot of flexibility, that maybe the jurisdiction, the city or the county, is given the ability to just refund taxes instead of creating a whole new exemption program for those. They would just let us know after the taxes are paid how much the value of that asset was, and we could calculate the taxes, and they could write a, do a refund check. That way we wouldn't have to set up a special exemption program for that. So that's in, that's also in my testimony. It would give the, it would give the cities a tremendous amount of flexibility that the legislators want, but it would, it would help us to administer the property tax program more efficiently. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, just a moment. Yes.
I have a question for Doug real quickly.
Please, go. Representative Davis.
Thanks for your testimony. And I have to leave because I've got mayors and county commissioners who I'm standing up right now, who are up in a conference room. Doug, thanks for your testimony. It seems to me many of these issues were raised directly with our chief sponsor, Senator Boquist.
Mm-hmm.
And out of respect for the Senate, I think many of these were brought up at the time, mm-hmm. And not adopted by the Senate after careful consideration. I just want that to be entered into the record.
And thank you, Representative Davidson. I would note that the reason that they're in the Dash 14 still is exactly that reason, that,
thank you.
That they were vetted. This discussion was, did occur in the Senate, and they chose to keep those provisions in the bill.
Thank you.
Representative, what's it?
Yes, I have a full Ways and,
Ways and Means Committee's
okay.
meeting.
Committee,
yes, and we want you at Ways and Means Committee and get those budget bills done.
Split me in half today.
Thank you. Thank
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Davis, I did let Senator Boquist know that I would continue to bring these issues up, even though they were passed by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I do, again, want to thank Senator Boquist. The original, this bill as originally written, the way it is now, it's much easier to administer for the assessors.
I'm sorry. Say that one more time.
When the bill was first submitted in the Senate side, and from what we see now, this version of the bill is much easier for us to administer. And I want to thank Senator Boquist for making those changes.
Okay, great. Yeah,
even though we didn't get all of what we asked for.
Right, right. You got part of
what we got part of what we asked for.
Okay, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Tammy Little, and I'm the Assessment and Tax Manager from Clackamas County. Today I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Tax Collectors as the current president. I would like to thank you for allowing me this opportunity to express a concern about this bill. What we're asking is that you would consider Section 3, the deferral option, to be removed. We understand the primary focus of this bill is the exemption piece, and we don't have any problem with that. But our concerns are on the deferral portion because of the complexities and the problems that we believe it would cause the tax collectors in administering that. Several points, one being the bill allows for prepayments and partial prepayments, but the statute doesn't really speak to how that would be done. These are future liabilities. It would be a tracking system for the tax collectors that would have to be done offline, so very complex. It turns a five-year deferral program into a 10-year program to administer. And also that this deferral is unlike any other deferral in Oregon. It's a future liability, so it's very different, and we're currently not set up for this. So again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Any further questions? Okay.
Noticing you had the gavel.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay. I am going to call up Mary Stern and Wendy Johnson.
I'm really ticked at this thing. It's the value of land you have to have for the land.
So,
it's going to be really problematic.
Okay, so.
This bill is a gutter shape.
Oh, it seems
like it's a big concern, right?
And also, hang on, thank you. And I'm sorry, I was trying to figure out who was already on there. Mark Garst from DOR, would you mind coming up here as well?
Vice Chair Warner, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I had the pleasure of working with Senator Boquist during the interim and also last session on Senate Bill 938, and this is sort of the son of Senate Bill 938. The League, you know, at the beginning had troubles with this bill and then got to a point where we could support it. I can explain why. The bill provides two new economic development tools, provides both a property tax exemption program and a deferral program. You can't have both. It's one or the other. So I know the assessors don't like the deferral program so well. We don't have a deferral program in Oregon right now, except for the senior deferral. But we think some cities and counties may choose to do that. Why? Well, an exemption, you're exempting the property, you're going to get nothing for that value, you know, what you've exempted. A deferral is you'll eventually get paid for what you exempted for the time being. And so we don't know that it will be used very often, but we think it should be an option. We are using, you know, we're dealing with the public's tax dollars, and it's basically a no-interest loan, effectively, by deferring it. Other states do use this tool, and so it's essentially a pilot by limiting it to this very small group of properties, industrial properties. So the way it's written, you can only do one program or the other. We don't know which one will be chosen by a county or city, but it would be at their discretion. So we support it because it is a new economic development tool that we don't have in our toolbox, and it allows us to be very flexible. Second reason we support it is both of these tools are totally local options. They can decide to adopt, they meaning the city or county can choose to adopt an exemption program or a deferral program or adopt neither. So there's no fiscal for us on that regard because we decide whether to do the program. There's a clear nexus between these tax incentives and economic development. You don't even qualify unless you're going to do improvements of at least, and now I'm looking at the new amendments. My understanding is it's $2 million. You don't even qualify. And then the new amendments also require more specificity on job requirements. The original bill left it more flexible, which we preferred, but these aren't too onerous, the new Section 5 requirements. But there's clearly a nexus. So you've heard me before this committee many times railing against property tax exemptions, but it's usually because they're being imposed on us and there is no nexus to economic development. These two programs clearly are. So we can support it for those reasons. It still allows, it has some base requirements and some defaults, but it still allows for flexibility. A city or county could add additional requirements to meet their needs, and we think that's really important. So not only is a local option, but we can tailor it even more and tighten it even more. Unlike an E-zone, which is 100% of the exemption, we can tailor it to what percentage works. We want to get the best deal. If a company's already there and they're trying to expand, if they don't need that full exemption, we can tailor it. And so that's why we supported it. It's very similar to the E-zone in that it is temporary. It's 3 years as the default, but it can be expanded to 5. So it is temporary. It's not like we're going to be losing tax dollars for a long time. It's a short-term incentive to get significant investment. So those are the big four reasons of why the League can support this bill. We have some concerns, and we're trying to figure out what all the Dash 14 amendments all mean. But the first one is obviously that it's now requiring a much higher threshold to even qualify. We're going from 1 million to qualify to, you could kind of read it as 3, because you have to have $1 million industrial property and you have to add 2 million. I think, to be fair, at the beginning, we were thinking industrial property is what this applied to. So that would be state industrial of 1 million. So that makes logical sense. But now you've added 2 million on top of it. So I think that's a concern that it just won't apply to some of the smaller industrial properties, which sometimes are the very businesses we're trying to expand. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that goes to what Mr. Cross was talking about. Second, the bill does narrow the location of where this either program can be used. The mental gymnastics of understanding that 40,000, I totally read it wrong, but I looked at the SIP and it is exactly the same language. And so we've that's been interpreted of what the rural SIP applies to. So now I am convinced that that is what it means, that it's just going to exclude those cities that are 40,000 or more. And that means 12 cities in Oregon would be excluded. The League has a population chart, and I can tell you those cities. The cities that it would exclude would be Portland, Eugene, Salem, Gresham, Hillsboro, Beaverton, Bend, Medford, Springfield, Corvallis, Albany, and Tigard. Lake Oswego is just at 37,000, so shortly they would also be excluded. And I'm not a UGB expert, and so I understand the metro area has other rules, so it may already exclude some of the other cities, but I'm not versed in that, but that's the population line of where 40,000 hits. So we're really concerned that this is a tool that, yes, it was really to be aimed at rural development, but it's a tool that is less than the E-zone. And so I'm just scratching my head thinking, why should Portland or Hillsborough or some other city be excluded from doing a lesser exemption than they could do with an E-zone? I mean, it just seems like it's a tool that is more flexible than the E-zone that has to be 100%. Last session, you passed a bill allowing unlimited E-zone. So I'm just curious why we are doing this on that point. But obviously, it's still a local option tool that we can support. It has enough sideboards to really make it economic development. But we had those two concerns on just the policy of why excluding cities, certain cities, and then bumping up the investment quite a bit. There's another new section that this amendment would add. It's section seven, requires reporting requirements. And usually I'm all about reporting requirements, but this one, we don't have a lot of this information. This is something that the assessor would have. So it's asking for real market value and just other reports that we just wouldn't have. And so I'm not sure how that would work practically. There's a section nine or section seven for local governments reporting back. And there's a section, I think it's eight, where the state would be reporting back on how this tool works. And so we just had some technical concerns with that. But I have not been able to read the dash 14s with a very high level of detail. So those are my comments for now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I got in late, so I'm not sure who's next. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Mary Stern, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. And AOC supported the bill that came over, 1565A. It was a long, tortured path to get here, as Wendy referenced. We had the son of 1565. And
the torture continued.
The torture continued for sure this afternoon. You mentioned we had 90 minutes to read the bill, and we spent the first 60 going around and round about what the rural definition with the 40,000. So Representative Davis hit it on the head until we read the SIP definition and learned it was the same thing. We were not really quite sure what was going on with that. But we at AOC are very grateful to Senator Boquist for his hard work and persistence in trying to find additional tools for cities and counties for economic development purposes. And we were grateful to the senator and the assessors for reaching a compromise on the on 1565A. We thought we had reached an agreement, and then I know that the assessors were never happy about the deferral, but they said they could live with the bill as it came out of the Senate side. I think the idea was nobody in their right mind is going to use that deferral, so why put it into law? I guess that's to be seen. Some people may wish to use it, so it's just another tool, as Wendy stated. And because the bill is permissive, each county and city, in consultation with the assessor, can determine what to include in the ordinance. Regarding the dash fives, 14. I'm dash 14s. I'm sorry. Thank you.
I think they didn't like it.
AOC, I think, likes actually the requirements that are in section five or section one, as Kyle listed him on the sheet here. We appreciate that there is a nexus with economic development, and that was our major concern with the bill last session, that there was no nexus. So we're glad to see that in here. We do, I don't know that I have, or AOC would have, as many concerns with the eligible location, but Wendy did raise some good points, and we will leave it at that. And the reporting requirement does not seem too onerous. However, you know, we could get that information from the assessors, and the assessors are able to charge a fee for the work that's going to be associated with this bill, and that perhaps that could cover some of that cost. And as Kyle's item number six, the definition of the rural area, we got it now, although we'll have to explain it probably again and again and again to people. But with that, I'll take any questions.
Great. Did you have a chance to talk?
I haven't yet.
Let's talk. Let's listen to the department.
Yes, Mark Gars for the Oregon Department of Revenue. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll try and keep my comments pretty brief here. Like everyone said, I really appreciate all the work that's gone into this bill. I know that this has been something that Senator Boquist has been working on for quite some time. Our comments on 938 were multiple pages. Now I had to bump up my font just to get to a full page. I mean, we really feel like a lot of our biggest concerns have been dealt with, but we still have a few lingering concerns, and I won't belabor them because we did bring them up on the other side. But we're neutral on the bill, but administratively there are some issues with the local option. It allows the city or county to set varied criteria, exemption schedules, percentage of exemption, terms. We appraise property all across the state, and we're going to have to know what each and every one of those programs do. And so it's going to take a good bit of work by on the part of our people. If you look at the fiscal, it's an indeterminate fiscal, but that's because we have no idea how many local jurisdictions are actually going to adopt these ordinances. And so I just kind of putting that out there, it's going to be a good bit of work, and it's going to require a lot of manual tracking on our part to make sure that we're properly administering the bill. There's a provision in the bill to prevent stacking of exemptions. You could not have received an exemption before. You can't receive an exemption after on the same property. That's going to be really hard for us to track. If a piece of equipment was bought used, we don't really know if it received an exemption at the location it was at before. And then if it sells later, we'll have a hard time. It's not like we put a tag on it to know that, you know, when it goes to the next location, it won't receive an exemption. So that may not be too practical. I think that the assessors and tax collectors covered our concerns with the deferral option. It's just kind of unprecedented, and it's probably a failure of imagination, but we like to see things that we've seen before, and this is really different for us. There's a concern, and it's not going to happen very often. I don't want to overstate it, but you could get into a situation where if you had some rapidly depreciating electronics equipment, after the fifth year, it's just not worth very much money. And you might put the taxpayers in a weird spot where they owe 5 years of back taxes, plus they owe the sixth year, and now they've got this piece of equipment that is kind of obsolete already because it was used to manufacture a chip that's no longer in vogue. So what do they do? Do they tell the assessor to come and take the piece of equipment, or do they pay the taxes? So it creates an odd situation, possibly. Again, not overselling it. Food processing equipment has like a 30-year life. You're not going to have that kind of a situation, but I could see it happening.
You're talking about the deferral situation.
No, yes, on the deferral situation. That's right.
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead.
And then finally, you know, the discussion about the local option, I think, is an interesting discussion. You know, this bill delegates the authority to the local jurisdictions to set some tax policy. And I think that, you know, at the department, we do have some concerns about that. Some jurisdictions are going to have great legal staff who are very familiar with putting together these types of ordinances, and maybe it's going to look really good. Other jurisdictions, maybe not so much. They're smaller. Maybe they don't have that kind of staff. And I know that you know how complex writing an exemption policy is. And it can't be lost on you that just having one person trying to come up with this, you could get some unexpected results. And so we're not looking at those today. We don't know what they'll look like exactly, but we find that to be a little concerning. And then the last thing is that, you know, with each city enacting different programs with different criterias, with different percentages, you're moving away from uniformity, obviously. And that's nothing unique in our system. You know, we have the Measure 50, which has, you know, says right in it that there is no uniformity for Measure 50. But the net result is still that we're moving away from that. And generally, we like things to move towards uniformity as opposed to away from it. So those are my comments.
Thank you. Questions for these three? We very much appreciate your testimony, and in a minute I may have some comments about that. Who have we not heard from? Oh, one person, and I'm not going to read the names correctly, am I?
Jürgen.
Yes. Ah, for some reason, your name and your handwriting and my vision don't go together well.
I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I have a sloppy handwriting. I'm used to writing my family name first, so this is how I got a little tangled up here. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address this amendment specifically. I think it is a really good improvement of
and
what...
And for the record, your name, please.
Oh, sorry. My name is Jürgen Kritschko, from representing Tax Fairness Oregon, but also like to speak as a parent. This amendment has seen quite some improvement to the original bill, and we are very grateful for that. But I think you missed one wonderful opportunity here to remove the education funding from those taxes abated under this provision. I think it's a great opportunity to get this into this bill. We heard from a couple of ladies and gentlemen before that probably the raising of the threshold is kind of critical, because if you have a business with 1 million already invested, basically doubling or asking it to triple the investment in there, that could be a challenge, especially in rural areas where businesses are smaller. So I would say encourage you maybe modify this one, but on the other hand, really exclude exclude school funding. Yeah, school funding is staffed here. I'm coming from a rather good school district, Lake Oswego. Being here for about 2 or 3 years, I decided to take my kids into private school. I was fortunate enough to fund this, but there are many who are not fortunate in this way. And I think it is about time that the legislature has the same creativity to increase school funding as we have creativity to find more and more tax credits.
Thank
I want
you.
To give this to your consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions? Let me just simply say I think the policy questions around the issue that you raise and several similar ones are compelling and important. I look seriously about inserting that idea in the Dash 14 amendment and decided it was simply too big a lift for a bill on a specific tax exemption. I think it's an issue that the legislature, as a part of a more general review of property tax issues, ought to address. And I really do appreciate your bringing it to our attention again.
I have to.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Does that raise any other questions? Thank you. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 1565? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House. Before I close the hearing, let me say this. Given the testimony that we've had, I have got into operation the development of another amendment. If you'll look at what's on the screen now, it would take the number three that's on the screen and restore that $1 million number, because we were criticized by several different witnesses for the change from 1 to 2 million. We'd restore the $1 million number, and it would remove number four, which appears to have a lot of complexity to it that probably isn't useful to us. And that would be the changes from the Dash 14. We are facing a severe time crunch. I am hoping that we might have this amendment and the paperwork done by tomorrow morning. Any chance of that?
You're doing a strike in the house. That's fairly easy. Mm-hmm. That's pretty easy to amend that.
Mr. Chair, I think there's a Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I think there's a chance we could do something by mid-morning. We have Senate Revenue at 9, where we have a couple of major bills, and we have a work group meeting prior to that involving property taxes. So we're thinking maybe sometime mid-morning or...
You're thinking about 10 o'clock or thereabouts?
We could shoot for that, Mr. Chair. We'd have to have an hour posting. Of course, the other fallback for you is we do have a meeting scheduled at 1 o'clock.
At 1 o'clock.
And that might be more realistic.
Well, and we have, it takes time for engrossment as well. I'm thinking about second reading is what I'm thinking about.
Yes.
That's the issue I'm thinking about.
I understand.
Given where we are in the session, what's your experience with engrossment for second reading? How long does it take?
We can get it done rapidly in this environment where there's very few bills out there. The biggest competition we have on that is there's a lot of bills coming out of Ways and Means.
Budget bills.
There's 28 of them coming out here.
Right. Oh, so there's really no advantage to meeting before 1 o'clock.
I don't think so, Mr.
All
Chair.
Right. All right.
Are you in Ways and Means?
No.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm trying to figure out how to get this bill to the floor so we can get it back to the Senate. Mm-hmm. For concurrence before adjournment. That's our problem. Well, I think you've heard it, colleagues. I was going to try to meet early tomorrow. It doesn't appear like that. That makes any sense.
Mr. Chair, I have made the request to council. So
the request is in.
Yeah.
So we will hope to have a Dash 36 or whatever the number is by then for you to consider tomorrow morning at some point.
Yes.
That will be exactly what we saw with the 14 minus number 3 and number 4. Number 4 simply goes away. Number 3 goes back to a million. Is that clear? Anybody have a question about what the change is? It's mostly a matter of changing one number and then removing a section. Yes, Representative Notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I don't think I've been paying as close attention to this as I should have been. At one point, I thought we were sort of moving an ombuds amendment. Are we still doing that? Like,
yes.
Are we going to do the dash 11s at one point? Where
no, play? No, that's it's all not in one piece.
Okay.
The dash 14 includes all the other previous amendments.
Stay tuned.
And the dash 36 or whatever the number turns out to be will be the same, but without the change from 1 million to 2 million and without number 4, it's up on the board.
All right.
Any other questions about it? So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1565. Obviously, we're not opening the work session. We haven't got the amendment we need. We'll meet tomorrow. This will be carried over till tomorrow for public hearing and work at 1 o'clock. We also, if you'll note, have the Senate bill that just came over on the tax credits. I think that's 1507. That we'll be hearing and maybe working tomorrow as well. So be prepared for a busy committee meeting at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And with that, the committee's adjourned.